I for a few seconds, then said, "Well, that's better than evil little fuck." "Not much." Scattered clouds scudded past the bright orange half-moon, and leaves swirled in the headlight beams. We were still within the boundaries of the state park preserve, but this area seemed to be a mixture of public and private land, and there were houses scattered along the highway. I noticed a lot of seasonal displays on the front lawns, corn stalks, pumpkins, and so forth. There were also some Halloween displays, witches, skeletons, vampires, and other assorted creepy stuff. Autumn was starkly beautiful and deliciously grim. I asked Kate, "Do you like autumn?" "No. Autumn is darkness and death. I like spring." "I like autumn. Do I need help?" "Yes, but you know that."
"Right. Hey, I learned a poem in high school. Want to hear it?"
"Sure."
"Okay." I cleared my throat and recited from memory. "Now it is autumn and the falling fruit and the long journey towards oblivion. Have you built your ship of death? Oh, have you?" She stayed quiet a moment, then said,
"That's morbid."
"I like it.
See someone when we get back."
We drove in silence, then Kate turned on the radio, which was set to a country western station. Some cowgirl with a twang was singing, "How can I miss you if you don't leave?" I said, "Do you mind turning that off? I'm trying to think." She didn't reply. "Kate? Darling? Hello?"
"John, radio communication."
"Say what?"
"There's UHF, ultra high frequency, VLF, very low frequency, and so forth. Isn't there an extremely low frequency? ELF?
Holy shit. I glanced at her.
"That's it.
That's what I was trying to remember. Radio antennas at Custer Hill."
"Do you think this means that Maddox is communicating with someone on an ELF frequency?"
"Yeah. I think Harry was saying, tune in to ELF."
"But why ELF? Who uses the ELF band? Military? Aviation?"
"I really don't know. But whoever uses it, it can be monitored." She pointed out,
"I'm sure if Maddox is receiving or transmitting, it's not in the clear. It's voice scrambled or encrypted."
"Right. But the NSA should be able to crack any encryption."
"Who would he be communicating with, and why?"
"I don't know. Meanwhile, we need to find out about ELF radio waves. Hey, maybe that's why everyone around here seems so weird. ELF waves. There are voices in my head. Someone is telling me to kill Tom Walsh."
"Not funny, John."
We drove on through the dark night. Then I said, "Bane Maddox. Nuclear. Extremely low frequency. I think everything we need to know is contained in those words."
"I hope so. We don't have much else."
I suggested, "Why don't we go to the Custer Hill Club and torture the information out of Maddox?"
"I'm not sure the FBI director would approve of that."
"I'm serious. What if this asshole is planning a nuclear event? Wouldn't that justify me beating the shit out of him until he talks?"
"It's the what if that bothers me.
And even if we knew with 99% certainty, we just don't do things like that. We don't do that."
"We will. The next time we're attacked again, especially if it's nuclear, we will start beating the shit out of suspects."
"God, I hope not."
She stayed quiet for a few seconds, then said,
"We need to report everything we've heard, learned, and guessed at. Let the Bureau take it from there."
She added,
"We don't need to carry this ourselves."
"Okay, but we need some time to perfect this."
"Well, all right. Let's say by this time tomorrow night, we go to Tom Walsh with whatever we have. Agreed?"
I didn't trust Walsh any longer, so I thought I might have to bend the rules and go directly to my NYPD boss on the task force, Captain Parisi.
"John?"
"We have a week," I reminded her.
John, we don't know if the planet has a week.
Interesting point. I said, let's see what happens tomorrow.
Chapter 28. It was less than 20 miles to the point, but the place was so secluded that despite Schaefer's directions and Max's map, Kate had to call the resort to guide us to the unmarked road. I put on my brights and proceeded slowly along a narrow, tree-covered lane that looked like a slightly improved Indian trail. Kate said, "This is so pretty." All I could see was a tunnel of trees in my headlights, but to be upbeat, and because I'd booked the place, I said, "I feel close to nature." About 4 feet on each side of the car, to be precise. We reached a rustic gate with an arch made of branches that had been twisted into letters that spelled The Point. The gate was closed, but there was a speakerphone beside it. I lowered my window and pressed the button, and a distorted voice came out of the speaker like a jack-in-the-box.
"May I help you?"
"I'd like a double bacon cheeseburger, large fries, and a Diet Coke."
"Sir?"
"Mr. and Mrs. Corey, registered guests."
"Yes, sir. Welcome to The Point."
The electric gates began to open, and the voice said,
"Please proceed to the first building on your left."
I drove through the gates, and Kate observed, "That was a little more friendly than the Custer Hill Club." "It better be, for $1,200 a night."
"This was not my idea."
"Right." Up ahead was a big wooden structure, and I pulled off the road. We got out, and as we walked up the path, the door opened and a young man waved to us and said, "Welcome. Did you have a good journey?" Kate replied, "Yes, thank you." We climbed the steps to the rustic building, and a casually dressed young man said, "I'm Jim." We all shook hands, setting the tone for our stay in this place, which I guessed was friendly, homey, and probably silly. Jim said, "Come on in." We entered the building, which was the resort office and also a gift shop, selling Adirondack artwork and some pricey-looking apparel, which caught Kate's attention. Women, I've noticed, are easily distracted by clothing stores, and I was certain that the ladies on the Titanic stopped at the ship's apparel shop for the half-price sinking sale on their way to the lifeboats. Anyway, we got past the clothing, and we all sat in comfortable chairs around a table. Jim opened our file and said, "Here's a message for both of you." He handed me a card on which was written in pen, "Call. From Mr. Walsh. Time, 7:17 p.m. Since I didn't recall either Kate or I telling Tom Walsh where we were staying, I reasoned that Walsh must have recently learned this from Major Schaefer. No big deal, but I needed to remind myself that Walsh and Schaefer were in touch. I gave the card to Kate, then glanced at my cell phone and saw there was no service. I asked Jim, "Are you totally out of the cell service area?"
"It comes and goes. The best service is when you stand in the middle of the croquet field."
He thought that was funny and chuckled, informing me, "Sometimes you get service if you stand at The Point." I couldn't resist and inquired, "What's The Point, Jim?" He cleared things up by answering, "Whitney Point on Upper Saranac Lake. It's here on the property." Jim cautioned us, "Actually, we discourage the use of cell phones on the property."
"Why is that, Jim?"
"It detracts from the ambiance."
"Figures. Are there phones in the room?"
"There are, but you can't get an outside line."
"Why are they there, Jim?"
"To communicate within the property."
"Am I cut off from the world?"
"No, sir. There is an outside phone in this office and one in the kitchen of the main lodge, which you may use. If anyone calls here, as Mr. Walsh did, we'll get a message to you."
"How?" "Smoke signals."
"By note or on your room phone."
"Okay." This had an unexpected upside, as well as a downside considering all the calls we needed to make in the next day or two. Jim continued with the check-in and said,
"2 nights, correct?"
"Correct."
Where's the bar?
I'll get to all that in a moment.
He went through his wrap, pushing printed information toward us, along with a souvenir picture book at the point, a map of the property, and so forth. Jim asked me,
How will you be settling your account?
How about a duel?
Sir?
Kate said to Jim,
Credit card.
She said to me, John, why don't you use your personal card rather than the corporate card? My credit card was stolen.
When?
About 4 years ago.
Why didn't you replace it?
Because the thief was spending less than my ex-wife. No one else seemed to think this was funny. I gave Jim my government R&I Associates corporate card, and he took an imprint. He marked our map with a highlighter, saying, If you follow this road past the warming hut and the croquet field, you'll come to the main lodge. Charles will be waiting for you there.
Where's the bar?
Right across from the main lodge in the Eagle's Nest. Right here. He put a big X on the spot. Enjoy your stay with us.
You too.
We left the office and Kate inquired, Why do you have to be such a bore?
Sorry.
No, you're not.
Are we going to call Walsh?
Sure. Where's the croquet field? We got in the car and proceeded down the road, passing the warming hut, whatever the hell that is, then drawing abreast of the croquet field, at which point I asked, Do you want me to run out there and call Walsh?
No. Charles is waiting.
At the end of the road was a big log structure with a front porch, the main lodge, from which another young gentleman, dressed in a tie and jacket, was waving to us. I pulled up, and we got out. The young fella bounded down the steps, greeted us, and introduced himself as Charles, adding, I believe I spoke to Mr. Corey earlier.
You did.
He made a joke and said, We've fed the bears.
Great. Can you feed us?
I think Charles wanted to feed me to the bears, but he said, In fact, dinner is being served now, and we've set two places for you. He looked at me and said, Jacket and tie are required for dinner.
I don't have either, Charles.
Oh, goodness. We can loan you a jacket and tie. Funny that Kate's black jeans passed muster, but I needed a tie and jacket. I said to Charles, That won't be necessary. Where's the bar? He pointed to yet another rustic building about 100 feet away and said, The pub is right there, sir. There are a number of self-service bars on the property, and all the staff are bartenders, but if you don't see any staff at any of the bars, please help yourself.
I might like this place.
Please follow me. We followed him up the porch steps and into a rotunda-shaped room, all done up in Adirondack style, which was starting to get on my nerves. Charles said, This is the entrance foyer to the main lodge, which was the home of William Avery Rockefeller. A nanosecond before I could get off a good one, Kate said, This is a beautiful room. Charles smiled.
It's all original.
Clearly, Charles enjoyed the finer things in life. In the middle of the room was a round table, on which sat an urn of flowers and a bottle of champagne in a silver ice bucket, with three fluted glasses. Charles popped the cork, poured, and handed us each a glass, then raised his own.
Welcome.
I really don't drink this stuff, but to be polite, and because I needed the alcohol, I clinked, and we all drank. Charles indicated a small room off the rotunda and said, Here is a complimentary self-service bar which is open all day and night for your convenience. It was convenient right now, but Charles continued, And here, he motioned toward an arched opening in the rotunda, is the Great Hall. I peeked into the Great Hall, which reminded me of the Great Hall where we'd sat with Bain Maddox. Except in this great hall, at the far end, were two large round dining tables in front of a big roaring fireplace. At each table were about 10 ladies and gentlemen, eating and drinking, and though I couldn't hear them, I was certain they were engaged in witty conversations that bordered on the banal. Charles said, "You can access your room, the Mohawk," which, by the way, was William Avery Rockefeller's master bedroom, "through the Great Hall, but since dinner is being served, you may want to go around to your outside entrance, which I'll show you in a moment." I suggested, "I think we need a drink first." He nodded, "Of course. If you leave me your keys, we'll take care of your car and put your luggage in your room." Kate replied, "We don't have luggage." And, apparently concerned that Charles was thinking she and I had just met at a truck stop or something, added, "This trip was sudden, and our luggage will be following tomorrow. In the meantime, can you provide us with some sundries? Toothbrushes, a razor, and so forth?" "Of course. I'll have some items delivered to your room." Women are very practical, not to mention concerned about what total strangers think. So, to be a good, loyal husband, I said to Charles, "We're celebrating our wedding anniversary, and we were so excited we packed the Bentley, then took the Ford by mistake." Charles processed that, then offered us another champagne, which I declined for both of us. "We'll be in the pub," I said. "Can you get some food over there?" "Certainly. If there's anything else you need, just ask anyone on staff." "How about a room key?" "There are no keys." "How do I get in the room?" "There are no locks." "How do I keep the bears out?"
"The doors have inside bolts."
"Can a bear?"
"John, let's get a drink."
"Right." I said to Charles, "My car has a key. Here it is. I need a wake-up call at 6 a.m.
"Yes, sir."
"Would you like breakfast in your room or in the Great Hall?" Kate replied, "I'd like breakfast in the room." We always have this disagreement about room service. I don't like to eat where I sleep, but women, I've noticed, love room service. Charles asked us, "Would you like to schedule a massage in your room?" I asked, "During breakfast?" Kate said, "We'll see what our schedule looks like tomorrow." "Is there anything else I can assist you with?" Kate replied, "Not at the moment. Thank you, Charles. You've been very helpful." I asked him, "Do you have pigs in the blanket?"
"Sir?"
"For the bar."
"I'll ask the chef."
"With mustard. I like the crust a little brown."
"Yes. I'll let him know."
"Ciao." We left the rotunda of the main lodge, and I said to Kate, "Wasn't I nice?"
"Not exactly."
She opened the car and retrieved her briefcase, and we walked the 30 yards to the building called the Eagle's Nest, in which was the place called the pub. The pub was yet another rustic room, and a rather nice one at that. It was cozy, with a small fire in the fireplace, and a game and card room that held a pool table, bookshelves, and a stereo system. I noticed there was no television. The pub half of the room had a long bar, behind which were shelves of beautiful liquor bottles, and no bartender. In fact, the place was empty, the guests being at dinner. This was like dying and going to heaven. I slid behind the bar and said to Kate, "Good evening, madam. May I offer you a cocktail?" She went along with my silliness.
"I believe I'll have a small sherry." "No? Make that a double Stoli, twist of lemon, 2 cubes.
"Excellent, madam." I set 2 short glasses on the bar, found the ice, the fruit, the Dewars, and the Stoli, and, with a bottle in each hand, filled the glasses to the brim. We touched glasses, and Kate said to Harry, "Rest in peace, buddy." Neither of us said anything as we each decompressed from a long, eventful, and very sad day. Finally, Kate said,
"Should we call Tom?"
I checked my cell phone again, and there was actually service. The use of cell phones is discouraged at the point, madam.
"What if it's important?"
"Then he'll call again." I freshened our drinks and said, "If the alcohol is free, how do they expect to make any money on us at $1,200 a night?"
She smiled. "Maybe they're hoping you go to bed early.
By the way, you should not have used your government credit card." I replied, Look at it this way. If the world is coming to an end, what difference does it make? She thought about that, but didn't answer. I continued, and if we save the world, do you think the government is going to make us reimburse them for this place?
Yes.
Really?
Positive.
Then what's my incentive to save the planet?
That's your job this week.
She sipped her drink and stared into the fire.
Well, if the world is going to end, this is a good place to be.
Right. So is the Custer Hill Club. She nodded. Do you play pool? I asked.
I have played, but I don't play well.
Sounds like a hustle. I came around the bar and went to the pool table where the balls were already racked. I set down my drink, took off my leather jacket, pulled my shirt tail out to hide my pancake holster, then I chose a pool stick. Come on, let's play. Kate slid off the bar stool, removed her suede jacket, and pulled her sweater over her holster. She rolled up her sleeves and chose a stick. I lifted the rack from the balls and said to Kate, "Since you're such a ball breaker, you break." I actually didn't say that. I said, "After you, madam." She chalked up, bent over the table, and shot. Good break, but none of the balls went in. I ran three balls, then missed an easy shot. I think the scotch was starting to affect my hand-eye coordination, or maybe I needed another scotch. Kate ran three balls, and I could see she'd played this game before. I missed another easy shot, and she said, "Are you drunk, or is this a hustle? I'm just not on my game tonight." She ran another four balls, and I conceded the game and racked up. I said, "Let's play for $5 a ball."
"We just did."
I smiled and asked her, "Where did you learn to play?" She grinned mischievously.
"You don't want to know."
The second game was closer because she was getting tipsy. I was actually having fun playing pool with my wife, who looked good leaning over the table and listening to the fire crackle in a nice, cozy room in the woods with a free bar. A young lady entered the pub carrying a tray of hors d'oeuvres, which I helped her set on the bar. She said,
"Hi, I'm Amy. Welcome to the Point. Can I make you a drink?"
"No," I replied, "but make yourself one." Amy declined my invitation and said,
"Here's a breakfast menu. Just pick what you want, and the time you want it delivered to your room, and call the kitchen."
I looked at the tray of sissy hors d'oeuvres and asked Amy, "Where are my pigs in the blanket?" She seemed embarrassed as she replied,
"The chef, he's, like, French, says he's never heard of that." She added, "I don't think we have any hot dogs."
"Amy, this is America. Tell Pierre..." Kate interrupted.
"Amy, ask the chef to use breakfast sausage."
She explained helpfully,
"Saucisse en croûte. With mustard. Okay?"
Amy repeated the French in an upstate accent, promised to return, and left. I said to Kate, "This country is going to hell."
"John, give it a rest. Try some of these."
She handed me a smoked salmon, which I refused. I expected real food here. I mean, we're in the woods. You know, like buffalo steaks or hunter's stew. I recalled my phone message to Harry and poured myself another scotch.
"I know this has been a very tough day for you, John. So, vent, drink, do whatever makes you feel better."
I didn't reply, but I nodded. We took our drinks back into the game room. I sat at the card table and Kate sat across from me. I opened a fresh deck of cards and asked her, "Do you play poker?"
"I have played, but not well."
I smiled. "Red chips are $1. Blue are $5. You're the bank." I shuffled as she gave each of us $200 worth of chips. I put the deck in front of her. "Cut." She did so, and I dealt 5-card draw. We played a few hands, and I was doing better at cards than I'd done at pool. I may have lost my hand-eye coordination, but I could play poker in my sleep. Kate glanced at her cell phone and said, I have one bar. That, I cocked my thumb toward the mahogany bar, is the only bar I'm interested in tonight.
I think we need to call Tom. Really.
Whoever loses this hand calls him. She lost the hand and $22, but won the right to call Tom Walsh. She dialed his cell phone. He answered, and she said,
Returning your call.
She put it on speaker, then set the cell phone on the table as she gathered up the cards. I heard him ask, Where are you? Kate said,
At the point. Where are you?
He replied, At the office, which I thought was interesting and unusual at this hour.
Can you talk?
She giggled.
Not very well. I've had 4 stolies.
She fan shuffled the deck near the phone, and Walsh said, I'm getting static.
I'm shuffling.
He seemed impatient with her. Where's John?
He's here.
I said, Ante up.
What?
She threw a dollar chip in and said to me,
Cut.
Walsh asked,
What are you doing?
Kate replied,
Playing poker.
Are you playing alone? She dealt 5 card draw and replied,
No, that's solitaire.
I mean, he said with affected patience, is anyone there aside from John?
No. Are you opening?
I threw a blue chip in the pot. Open for 5. She threw 2 blues in.
Raise you 5.
Walsh asked, Do you have it on speaker?
Yes. How many cards do you want?
2. She hit me with 2 cards and said,
You better have something better than 3 of a kind, mister. Dealer stands pat.
You're bluffing. Walsh said, Excuse me. Would you mind holding up your game for a minute of business? Kate put her hand face down on the table and whispered to me,
To you.
You raised my open. It's to you.
Are you sure?
Walsh said, It's to you, Kate. But before you bet, perhaps John can tell me how it went with Major Schaefer. I put my hand face down, sipped my scotch, and said, Since you know we're at the point, I assume you've spoken to him.
So what did he tell you?
He said Kate was not present at the meeting. Correct. I did a cop to cop with him.
That's what I was afraid of.
And? What did he tell you? I asked. He told me that you told him about our bet. I guess you're in a betting mood today. That was about as witty as Tom Walsh got, and I wanted to encourage him in that direction, so I laughed. He asked, Have you been drinking? No, sir. We're still drinking. I see. Well, weren't you supposed to call Schaefer before we got there to tell him that Kate and I are the designated investigators?
Apparently.
Even drunk, you don't forget an oversight on my part. Tom, even if I was dead, I wouldn't forget you screwing me around. Mr. Walsh advised me, You need to learn to manage your anger. Why? It's the only thing that motivates me to come to work. Walsh ignored that. Was Schaefer helpful? Did you learn anything? Tom, whatever Schaefer told me, he'll tell you. He loves the FBI. He suggested, I think we need to continue this discussion when you're less fatigued. I'm fine.
Okay,
he said. Just FYI, Harry's body is being flown by helicopter back to New York for autopsy. He added, I understand there were signs of physical abuse on the body. I didn't reply. Walsh continued, This is obviously not a hunting accident, and the Bureau is treating it as a homicide. What was your first clue? I added, Fax me the full autopsy report, Kara Schaefer. He ignored that. A team of agents have arrived from New York and Washington, and they'd like to speak to both of you tomorrow. As long as they're not here to arrest us, we'll talk to them. Don't be paranoid. They just want a full briefing from you both. Right. Meanwhile, you need to get a federal judge to issue a search warrant for the Custer Hill Club property and lodge ASAP. That's being discussed. Kate cut in.
Tom, John and I think that Bain Maddox is conspiring to do something that goes beyond oil price fixing.
There was a silence. Then Walsh asked, like what?
We don't know.
She looked at me and mouthed the words, mad, nuke, elf. I shook my head. Like what? She replied,
I don't know.
Then why do you think that? I said, let's discuss this when you're sober, Tom.
Call me in the morning.
I know that place doesn't have room phones and that cell service is not good, but don't fuck with me, he added, and don't even think about submitting a bill for that place. He hung up. I said to Kate, it's to you. She threw three blues in the pot.
Don't even think about raising. In fact, don't even call.
15 and another 15. She threw in three more blue chips and said,
I'll let you off easy.
She fanned out a jack-high straight flush in hearts and swept the pot toward her.
What did you have?
None of your business. She gathered the cards and shuffled the deck.
You're a bad loser.
Good losers are losers.
Macho, macho.
You love it. We played a few more hands, and I was ahead a little on the poker, though still down on the pool. I suggested, let's do darts. $1 a point. She laughed and said,
you can't even get your glass to your mouth. I'm not standing in the same room as you with a dart in your hand.
Come on. I got up, a little unsteady, and said, this is like a saloon triathlon. Poker, pool, and darts. I found the darts, stepped back about 10 feet from the board, and let them fly. One hit the board, and the others, unfortunately, went astray, the last one pinning a window drape to the wall. Kate thought that was funny, and I said, let's see how you do. She informed me,
I don't play darts, but you can go again.
She laughed. Amy returned with a cloth-covered tray, which she set on the bar.
Here we are. He had apple-smoked turkey sausage.
Before I could tell her what Pierre could do with his turkey sausage, Kate said,
thank you.
Amy was looking at the darts in the wall, but didn't comment, except to ask,
have you decided on breakfast?
We perused the menu and ordered breakfast, which even a French chef can't screw up. I wanted to watch the evening news, and I asked Amy, where's the TV? She replied,
there are no televisions at the point.
What if the world came to an end? We couldn't see it on television. She smiled, the way people do who know they're dealing with an inebriated person. She addressed Kate, whom she probably thought was sober.
Yeah, like, we had that problem on 9/11, you know?
So they set up a TV here in the bar, so everyone could watch it. She added,
it was really horrible.
Neither Kate nor I commented, and Amy wished us a pleasant evening, stole another glance at the darts, and left. I uncovered the tray and examined the turkey sausage wrapped in some kind of phyllo dough. What is this crap? Kate said,
we're checking out of here tomorrow.
I like it here.
Then stop complaining and eat those fucking sausages.
Where's the mustard? There's no mustard.
Time for bed, John.
She handed me my leather jacket, put on a coat, gathered up her handbag and briefcase, then led me out the door. I shoved my Glock in my waistband in case we ran into any bears and suggested that Kate do the same, but she ignored my good advice. The air was cold, and I could see my breath, and in the sky were thousands of bright stars against the black sky. I could smell the pines and the wood smoke coming from the chimneys of the main lodge, and everything was very quiet. I like the noise of the city, and concrete below my feet, and I don't miss seeing the stars at night because the lights of Manhattan create their own universe, and 8 million people are more interesting than 8 million trees. And yet, this was undeniably beautiful, and under other circumstances, I might relax here and surrender to the wilderness and be at peace with myself while eating French food with 20 strangers who probably made their money screwing the American public. Kate said,
"It's so serene. Can't you feel the tension and stress just leaving your body?"
"I'm kinda going back and forth on that."
"You need to let go and let nature take over."
"Right. Actually, I'm starting to get in touch with my primitive self."
"John, this may come as a surprise to you, but you're already very in touch with your primitive self. In fact, I haven't yet met the other side of you."
I wasn't sure if that was a compliment or a criticism, so I didn't reply. We went around the main lodge and onto a stone terrace. We could see through the big windows into the great hall, and I watched the guests around the two tables, working hard at the game of civilized dinner behavior. None of them were local, of course, and wherever they'd come from, they'd arrived. I thought of Bane Maddox sitting in his great hall, fireplace, dog, hunting trophies, old scotch, a manservant, and probably a girlfriend or two somewhere. For 99% of humanity, this would be more than enough. But Mr. Bane Maddox, though he should have been very content with his accomplishments and wealth, was being directed by some inner voice into a dark place. I mean, thinking back on that meeting, I could see something in his eyes and in his demeanor that made me believe he was on a mission, a man of destiny, far above the rest of humanity. I'm sure he had reasons for whatever he was up to, reasons that he thought were good and which he'd actually hinted at over scotch and coffee. But I didn't care about his reasons, or his inner demons, or his divine voices, or his obvious megalomania. What I cared about was that he was apparently engaged in a criminal enterprise, and that he'd most likely killed a friend of mine on his way toward his larger goal, which itself was undoubtedly beyond criminal. Kate asked me,
"What are you thinking about?"
"Maddox, Harry, nukes, radio signals, stuff like that."
"I know we'll figure it all out."
"Well, Kate, the nice thing about this mystery is that even if we don't figure it out, we'll know soon enough what it was that we couldn't figure out."
"I think it would be better if we figured it out before it happens."
We reached the rear of the main lodge without encountering any carnivorous wildlife, and I saw a door with a wooden sign that said, "Mohawk." We entered the unlocked door, and I bolted it, not sure if the door would keep a bear out. Maybe I should move the dresser in front of it. Kate said,
"Oh, this is beautiful."
"What?"
"The room. Look at this place."
"Okay." I looked. It was a big cathedral-ceilinged room, paneled in stained pine. There was a king bed that looked like it could be comfortable, but it was so high off the floor you wouldn't want to fall out of it. On the bed was a wicker basket full of toiletries. There was a lot of furniture in the room, and lots of throw pillows and blankets lying around, which I know women like. As Kate went around feeling up the fabrics and smelling the flowers, I checked out the bathroom. I'm a bathroom freak, and this one was okay. I like a good toilet bowl. I washed my face in the sink, then returned to the main room. Along the far wall was a big stone fireplace, and in the hearth were logs and kindling, to which Kate was holding a match. The fire caught, and she stood and said,
"This is so romantic."
Above the fireplace was a huge set of antlers, which reminded me that I was horny. I said, "I'm horny."
"Can't we just enjoy the room?"
"You said it was romantic." "So?"
Romance and sex are not the same thing.
I knew if I argued that point, I wasn't going to get any. So I said, I'm very sensitive to that. Here, let me put some music on. There was a CD player on the desk and a stack of discs. I quickly found an Etta James CD, which I knew she liked, and popped it in. Etta began crooning at last. Kate found a bottle of red wine on a dining table, which she opened. Then she poured two glasses and gave one to me. To us. We touched glasses, sipped, and kissed lightly on the lips. I'm not a big wine drinker, but I've discovered that wine equals romance, and romance leads to whatever. Kate went around and shut off the lamps. We took off our shoes and sat in comfortable upholstered chairs that faced each other in front of the roaring fire. Kate said, "This was a good idea, except it's too expensive." "Hey, I got an oil tip from Bain. We're buying oil futures tomorrow as soon as the market opens. Then I'm calling my bookie with my bet on the start date of the war. Do you think this war has anything to do with what Maddox is up to?"
"Possibly."
"Yeah, maybe Maddox is gonna nuke Baghdad and keep us from having to go to war. Could that be his game?"
"I don't know. Why speculate?"
"This is called analysis. This is what we get paid for."
"I'm off duty."
"Would nuking Baghdad raise or lower the price of oil? And how can I bet on the start date of the war if the war is preempted by a nuclear blast? What do you think?"
"I think you should stop thinking about this tonight."
I looked around the darkened room, lit now by the fire. The reflection of the flames glowed on the shiny oil paintings along the walls. The wind had picked up, and I could hear it howling in the chimney and saw gusts of leaves blowing past the windows. I said, "This actually is romantic. I see the difference now." She smiled and replied, "You're on the right track." "Good. Hey, do you realize that William Avery Rockefeller had sex in this very room?"
"Is that all you think about? I mean, here we are in one of the historic great camps of the Adirondacks, and all you can think about is that some Rockefeller had sex in this room."
"That's not true. I was about to comment on the pastoral movement among the rich in the early part of the last century that led to the construction of these rural homes as simple refuges from the complexities of urban life, with all its noise, pollution, and teeming humanity."
"That's interesting."
"Also, the Rockefellers were horny. I mean, look at what happened to poor Nelson Rockefeller. Then you have Oysters Rockefeller. Oysters. Get it? So, for me to mention that William Avery..."
"John, you're losing points."
"Right. So we listened to Etta James, watched the fire, and sipped wine. The heat of the fire was making me drowsy, and I yawned. Kate stood, went to the bed and removed the comforter and a pillow, which she laid out in front of the hearth. She then slipped into something more comfortable, meaning nothing, and I watched her as she undressed in the firelight. When she was naked, she lay down on the comforter and looked at me. I think that was my signal to join her, so I stood and undressed slowly, about 5 seconds, and we lay on our sides in each other's arms. She nudged me onto my back and rolled on top of me. This had been a lousy day, and tomorrow, assuming there was one, wasn't going to be much better. But for now, this was as good as it got.
Part 10. Tuesday. Upstate New York. The unleashed power of the atom has changed everything, save our modes of thinking, and we thus drift toward unparalleled catastrophe. Albert Einstein. Chapter 29. Our wake-up call came promptly at 6 a.m., making me wonder what I was thinking when I asked for it. Little Scotsmen were hurling stones in my head. Kate rolled over, mumbled something, and buried her head under the pillow. I found a bathroom in the dark and used the provided sundries, then stepped into the shower, which felt like $1 million, or at least $1,200. I went back into the bedroom and got dressed in the dark, leaving Sleeping Beauty to rest. Actually, we'd both spend a restless night after an overstimulated day. For the first time in a long time, I dreamed I was standing under the burning towers as people jumped from the windows. I also dreamed that Harry and I were at a funeral. I opened the other entry door to our room and saw that it led to a short passageway, which opened into the great hall. I went into the hall, where two round tables were being set for breakfast, and a fire was blazing at each end of the room. If I wasn't a cop, I think I'd like to be a Rockefeller. The kitchen door was open, and I could hear the sounds of people banging around, preparing for breakfast. I thought I heard a voice with a French accent saying, "Pigs in the blanket," followed by laughter, but maybe I imagined that. On a side table were coffee and muffins. I poured a cup of black coffee, walked out through the French doors onto the terrace, and took a deep breath of the mountain air. It was still dark, but I could see that the sky was clear, and it was going to be another nice day in God's country. There is a belief in law enforcement, reinforced by experience and statistics, that the first 48 hours of a criminal investigation are the most critical. Intelligence work and counter-terrorist operations, on the other hand, move at a slower pace. There are good reasons for this, but my instinct and experience as a cop told me that almost everything you need to know, and almost everything you're going to discover, is going to happen in 2 days, maybe three. What you do with that time and information is the difference between a successfully concluded case or a muddled clusterfuck of meddling bosses, brain-dead prosecutors, lawyered-up suspects, and half-witted arraignment judges. If you give all these people time to think, you're into paralysis by analysis. As I was having my morning inspirational thoughts, Kate came out on the terrace wearing the guest bathrobe and slippers and carrying a cup of coffee. She yawned, smiled, and said, "Good morning." "Good morning, Mrs. Rockefeller." Married or not, the morning protocol après sex was a kiss, a compliment, and a reference to the lovemaking that was romantic without sounding wimpy and explicit without sounding piggish. I managed to pull all this off, and we stood on the terrace, arm in arm, sipping coffee, looking out at the pines and autumn leaves. The sun was coming up, and there was a mist lying on the ground, sloping downward toward Upper Saranac Lake, which looked very tranquil. It was quiet, and the air smelled of damp earth and wood smoke. I could see why Harry liked it up here. And I pictured him waking up Saturday morning in his camper to a scene very much like this before he started out for the Custer Hill Club. Kate said, "Maybe when we finish here, we'll take a week off and rent a cabin on a lake. Wouldn't that be nice?" I thought that if this case ended badly, we wouldn't have to take a week off. We'd have lots of free time. Kate added, "I think that might be a fitting tribute to Harry. That would be very nice." Kate was cold, so we went back into the great hall. Another couple was on a couch near the fireplace in the sitting area. We refilled our cups and sat on a couch opposite them. My body language clearly indicated that I had no intention of engaging them in conversation. The guy, a bearded, middle-aged gent, gave me the same signals. His wife or girlfriend, however, smiled and said, "Hi, I'm Cindy. This is my fiancé, Sonny."
Sonny did not look sunny. In fact, he looked grumpy. Maybe he just got the bill. Cindy, on the other hand, was happy and friendly, and would probably talk to a goldfish in a bowl. Kate and Cindy began to chat about the point, the Adirondacks, and whatever. Grumpy and I stayed silent. The fire felt good. Cindy and Grumpy were from Long Island, and he was, according to Cindy, in the publishing business. Cindy was in public relations, and that's how they met. Thank God she didn't tell the story, but I was certain one of them must have been drunk. Kate said she was an attorney, which was partly true, and she told them I was a certified social worker, working in the Muslim immigrant community, which was funny, but Grumpy made a little snorting sound of disapproval. The subject somehow shifted to shopping, and Cindy informed Kate that there were good shops in the village of Lake Placid. My eyes glazed over, and I thought Grumpy's eyes would do the same, but I noticed he was looking at Kate, whose robe had opened a little at the top. The man was clearly a pig. On that subject, I couldn't help noticing that Cindy was also very pretty, with long blonde hair, hazel eyes, Nordic features, and really great presence, and so forth. She looked about 20 years younger than her so-called fiancé, and I couldn't imagine what she found attractive about him, except for maybe the bulge in his pants. I mean, his wallet. Grumpy broke his silence and said to me, "I have a good idea about immigration. Wherever you were born, stay there." He stood, took a last look at Kate's cleavage from a better angle, and said to her, not me, "Nice meeting you." Cindy, too, stood and said to us, "We'll see you at dinner. The chef is doing woodcock tonight." Woodcock? I got to my feet. "I hear that his woodcock is firm and moist." Cindy smiled tightly. "John," Kate said, then turned to our new friends. "Have a good day." Grumpy replied, "I've made other plans." And off they went. Kate said to me, "A totally mismatched couple. Us or them?" Grumpy had left the New York Times on the couch, and I scanned the front page. One headline read, "U.S.-French split on Iraq deepens." I said to Kate, "See? If these people ate real food like the Irish and the English, they'd have some balls. Who eats snails?" Here's another story. A fireworks display at Disneyland outside of Paris caused the nearby French army garrison to drop their weapons and surrender to a busload of Swedish tourists. "John, it's really too early for this." Woodcock. I read the main headline, which said, "Bush ties bombing at Bali nightclub to Qaeda network." I scanned the story and saw that some Islamic militants were pressing a theory that the United States had masterminded the Saturday attack as a means to manipulate the Indonesian government and to strengthen its argument for a war against Islam. The Islamic militants had said the same thing about the 9/11 attacks. It was an interesting theory, with just enough plausibility to make some people wonder. I mean, I'm not a conspiracy nut, but I could imagine that there were people in this country, in and out of the government, who wanted an excuse to widen the war against terrorism to include certain Islamic countries, like Iraq. I thought of something that one of the spookier CIA guys at the ATTF once said, "What we need is one more good attack." I think I can do without that, thank you, but I got what he was saying. Kate said to me, "I'm going to the room to shower. What are you doing?" I looked at my cell phone and saw I had no service. "I need to call Schaefer to set up an appointment to see the crime scene, so I'll use the kitchen phone. See you in the room. Be nice to Pierre. Oui, oui." She left, and I went into the kitchen. The place was bustling, and no one seemed to notice or care that I was there, so I found the phone, which was on the wall, and dialed the state trooper headquarters. I got the desk sergeant, who put me on hold. The kitchen smelled of frying pork products, and my stomach grumbled. I opened the Times to the obit page, but I didn't see Harry Muller. It might be too soon for an obituary, or maybe it wouldn't run in the Times. I scanned the Metro section to see if there was a story about Harry's death, but I didn't see anything. An upstate hunting accident wasn't exactly news, but the murder of a federal agent was. Therefore, the FBI and local police would issue a joint statement saying the death was an apparent accident, but was still under investigation. Any news organization that called for further information would be asked to hold the story so as not to upset the family and/or tip off a possible suspect. You could usually buy a few days with that. A waitress walked by, and I said to her, "Do me a favor and check on the breakfast for Corey. Mohawk room. I could really use a bacon sandwich on rye." "Now?" "Please. With coffee." She hurried off, and Major Schaefer came on the line. "Morning." I could barely hear him over the sounds of the kitchen noise, and I said loudly, "Good morning. What's a good time to go out to the crime scene?" "Be here at 8. I'll meet you in the lobby." "Thanks. Anything new?" "I spoke to Dr. Gleason last night." "Nice lady. She said you went a little beyond identifying the body and paying last respects." "I told you. She showed us the signs of physical abuse." "Yeah? Did you handle any of the personal effects?" "Absolutely not. All of them." He asked, "Find anything, detective?" "No. Just the writing in Harry's pocket and the cell phone calls." "Remove anything?" "No. Just the map of the Custer Hill property." "My troopers say that you and your wife never signed in or out." "Tell you what, Major, why don't you and I go to the morgue after the crime scene?" "Too late. The feds snatched the body last night." "I told you. You gotta act fast." "Thank you." The waitress put a tray on the counter and said, "Your breakfast will be delivered at 7. "Thanks. Add some of those biscuits that just came out of the oven." Schaefer asked, "How's the point?" "Great. All the booze is free." "How are we doing with the search warrant and surveillance?" I took a big bite of the bacon sandwich. Heaven. "Forget the search warrant for now. But I did begin the surveillance last night." "Anything?" "Yeah. At 8:03 p.m., two vehicles left the subject property. One was a Ford van registered to the Custer Hill Club. The other was a Ford Taurus registered to Enterprise Rent-A-Car." I washed down the bacon with coffee and asked, "Where'd they go?" "They went to Adirondack Regional Airport. The commercial terminal is closed at that hour, and they left the Taurus in an Enterprise spot and put the keys in a drop slot. Then both drivers, two males, got in the van and returned to the Custer Hill Club." "What do you make of that?" "Looks suspiciously like they were returning a rental car. What do you think?" Major Schaefer had a wry sense of humor. I said, "Check the trunk for a body. What was the plate number on the Taurus?" "I don't have it in front of me," which was his polite way of saying, "What have you done for me lately?" I said, "I saw a blue Enterprise Taurus at the Custer Hill Lodge when I was there." I gave him the plate number from memory and asked, "Is that it?"
"Sounds like it. I'll call Enterprise and find out who rented that car."
I thought I probably had that information from Kate's friend Larry at Enterprise, but I said, "Good. Anything else from the surveillance?"
"No. What are we looking for?"
"You never know. But I'd like to know that Maddox is still on the property."
"Okay.
So, someone needs to call me any time you see any activity. Hold on. Some kid in a dopey psychedelic chef's outfit was trying to get my attention. I asked him, "What do you need?"
"I need to use the phone. I have to place an order."
"What do you have to order?"
"Woodcock."
"I'm on top of the woodcocks. How many do you need?"
"I need the phone, sir."
"Hey, I'm trying to save the world here, pal.
Hold on. I said to Schaefer, I'm using the kitchen phone. I'll see you at 8. I hit the cradle and handed the phone to the chef. If the world comes to an end, it's your fault. A handsome guy in tailored whites, whom I just knew was the French chef, came up to me and extended his hand. Good morning, he said in an accent. We shook. You are, of course, Mr. Corey. Oui.
Ah, you speak French?
Oui.
Bon.
I am Henri, the head chef, and I must apologize profusely for the pigs in the blanket.
He got the pronunciation right, if not the recipe. I said, hey, don't worry about it, Henry.
But I do. So, for you, I have ordered the ingredients, and tonight we serve the pigs for the cocktail hour.
Terrific. I like the crust a little brown.
Yes, of course.
He leaned toward me and whispered, I too like these little things. I was sure by now that he was pulling my chain, and I said, I won't tell. Okay, don't forget the mustard. See you later.
May I show you my kitchen?
I looked around. Looks good.
You are welcome to place any special order for any meal.
Great. I've been thinking about woodcock lately.
Ah, amazing. Tonight is woodcock.
You don't say. Well, hell, I ought to play the lottery today.
Yes? Oh, I understand.
I looked at my watch and said, well, I...
A moment.
He pulled a scrap of paper from his pocket and said, here is the menu for this evening. He read,
we begin with a ragout of forest mushrooms, followed by a crisp fillet of Arctic char, served with pepperonade and beurre rouge.
I think perhaps a California Chardonnay with that, yes?
Then the woodcock, which I will serve with an étouffée of local vegetables and a port wine jus. I am considering a French Cabernet Sauvignon with the woodcock. What do you think, Mr. Corey?
Sounds like a crowd pleaser.
Good. And we end with an exploration of chocolate.
Perfect ending.
With a sauterne, of course.
Goes without saying. Okay.
Will you and your wife be joining us for lunch?
No. We have to be at a chipmunk race. Thanks for...
Well, I must pack for you a picnic lunch. When are you leaving?
20 minutes. Don't bother.
I insist. You will find a picnic hamper in your car.
He extended his hand, we shook, and he said,
we may have our differences, but we can remain amis. Yes?
Well, geez, I was really feeling bad now about my anti-French attitude, so I said, together we can kick some Iraqi ass. Right? Henry wasn't sure about that, but he smiled.
Perhaps.
Can do. See you later. As I made my way out of the kitchen, I heard Henry barking orders for a picnic lunch. Hold the snails, Henry. I got back to the room and said to Kate, who was in front of the vanity fussing with makeup, we have to move fast. State Police HQ at 8.
Breakfast is on the table. What did Major Schaefer say?
I'll tell you on the way. Where's your briefcase?
Under the bed.
I reached under the bed, pulled out a briefcase, and began flipping through the stack of Enterprise rental agreements as I stood at the table and uncovered the basket of hot biscuits.
What are you looking for?
Butter.
John?
Ah, here it is.
What?
The Enterprise rental agreement with the plate number of the car we saw at the Custer Hill Club. I put the agreement on the table and buttered a biscuit.
Who rented the car?
This may be interesting.
What?
This guy's name. It's Russian. Mikhail Putyov. She thought about that.
Doesn't sound like a member of the club to me.
Me neither. Maybe Maddox invites old Cold War enemies to the club to reminisce. Still standing, I dug into the omelet and asked Kate, do you want breakfast or do you want to keep painting? No reply. We have to get going. No reply. Sweetheart, can I bring you your juice, coffee, and a piece of toast?
Yes, please.
I'm not that well trained yet, but I'm learning. I brought her juice, buttered toast, and coffee to the vanity table and asked, do you have cell service?
No.
I need to make another call from the kitchen.
Who are you calling?
Someone who can get a make on this Russian guy.
Call our office.
I'd rather not. She informed me,
we're already in trouble, John. You understand that, don't you?
Here's the way the world works. Information is power. If you give away your information, you give away your power to negotiate the trouble you're in.
Here's the way my world works, Kate replied. Stay out of trouble.
I think it's too late for that, sweetheart.
Chapter 30.
I went back into the great hall where about a dozen people, including Cindy and Sonny, were now scattered around the two tables having breakfast. Cindy smiled and waved. Sonny was looking for Kate. I re-entered the kitchen and the same kid was on the phone again, placing another order. I said to him, Henry wants to see you, now.
Huh?
I need the phone, now. He got sulky on me but hung up, then stomped off. Young people need to learn patience and respect for others. I got the number I needed from my cell phone directory and dialed. A familiar voice answered, Kern's Investigative Service. I said, I think my dog is an Iraqi spy. Can you do a background check on him?
Who is Corey?
Hey, Dick. I got this French poodle who every Friday night turns toward Mecca and starts howling. He laughed and said, shoot the dog.
Hey, how you been?
Great. You?
Terrific. Where are you calling from?
What's the point?
The point of what?
Oh, it's the place I'm staying at. Saranac Lake.
Vacation?
Job. How's Mo?
Crazy as ever. How's Kate?
Great. We're working this together. We made polite small talk for a minute. Dick Kearns is former NYPD homicide, part of my blue network, which I noticed was getting smaller every year as guys retired and moved, or died natural deaths, or like Dom Finelli and six other guys I knew, died in the line of duty on 9/11. Dick was also briefly assigned to the ATTF, where he'd gotten a top-secret clearance and learned how the feds worked. So when he retired, he got a gig doing background checks for the FBI on a freelance basis. He's in a growth industry since 9/11, and he's making more money than he ever did as a cop with half the stress. Good for Dick. The small talk out of the way, I said to him, Dick, I need some info on a guy.
Okay, but I'm up to my ears in work. I'll do what I can. When do you need it?
Noon. He laughed.
I have 10 background checks I'm doing for the FBI, and they're all late.
Give them all top secret clearances and send the bill. Look, for now, I just need some public record stuff and maybe a few phone calls to follow up.
Noon?
I noticed that some of the staff seemed interested in my conversation, so I lowered my voice and said to Dick, it may be a matter of national security.
And you're calling me? Why don't you have your own office do it?
I asked, and they referred me to you. You're the best.
John, are you sticking your nose where it doesn't belong again?
Apparently, Dick remembered that he'd helped me unofficially with the TWA 800 case, and now he thought I was up to my old tricks again. I was, but why trouble him with that? I said, I'll owe you a big favor.
You owe me from the last time. Hey, whatever happened with that TWA 800 thing?
Nothing. You ready to copy?
John, I do this for a living. If I help you, I could go broke, get fired, or get arrested.
First name, McHale. I spelled it. He sighed, spelled it back to me, and asked,
Ruski?
Probably. Last name, Putyov. I spelled it, and he confirmed.
I hope you've got more than that.
I'm going to make this easy for you. I've got a car rental agreement, and unless this guy used false ID, I've got all you need.
Good. Let's have it.
I read him all the pertinent information from the Enterprise rental agreement, including Putyoff's address, which was Cambridge, Massachusetts. Dick said,
Okay, this should be easy. What's this guy up to? What is your area of interest?
I don't know.